Following are comments on William Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, Act 3. There are things in this comedy of Pyramus and Thisbe that will never please. The actors continue to work through their concerns about both excessive and defective realism in their play. The representation of a sword, a lion, a wall, and moonshine all require attention. In Act 3, Scene 1, our artisan actors are hard at work, rehearsing in the forest for the nobility's future viewing pleasure. Bottom continues to worry about excessive realism. Quote unquote, "There are things in this comedy of Pyramus and Thisbe that will never please," he says. And one of those things is that, quote unquote, "Pyramus must draw a sword to kill himself, which the ladies cannot abide." Act 3, Scene 1, Lines 8 through 10. While the inexperienced critics Snout and Starveling want to get rid of the play's violence altogether, Bottom finds a better solution. The 18th century French author and critic Denis Diderot is generally credited with naming the fourth wall in drama. Diderot is spelled D-I-D-E-R-O-T. But the habit of maintaining or erasing the imaginary stage front barrier between audiences and actors has been around since the beginning of drama. What Bottom proposes to do is to step outside his role temporarily and, in a prologue, directly tell the audience not to be afraid of the sword since it's only a prop in the play they're watching. We might call it a Renaissance drama trigger warning for scenes of violence, catastrophic misunderstanding, and tragically frustrated love pursuits. We've been warned. Snout worries about the lion, so Bottom decrees that he must show his human features through his suit. Quote unquote, "Half his face must be seen through the lion's neck, and he must address the audience and," quote unquote, "tell them plainly he is Snug the Joiner." Act 3, Scene 1, Lines 32 through 33 and 39 through 40. The workmen, then, think the audience will be traumatized by the sight of a whimsical man in a lion's suit, which implies that the audience is not capable of distinguishing between dramatic or fictive representations and everyday reality. The issue of representing moonlight must also be worked out, and here the matter concerns not excessive realism, but an insufficient amount of it. Act 3, Scene 1, Lines 51 through 55. Aside from reproducing moonlight, the second similar difficulty is how to represent a wall, but Bottom has an ingenious strategy to deal with this. An actor will stand on stage and either be outfitted to look like a wall, or he will create a crack with his hands, which will signify the fissure through which Pyramus and Thisbe speak. The language Bottom uses is significant. Quote unquote, "Some man or other must present wall, and let him have some plaster or some loam, or some rough cast about him to signify wall. Or let him hold his fingers thus, and through that cranny shall Pyramus and Thisbe whisper." Act 3, Scene 1, Lines 57 through 60. Is this an attempt to supply the realistic detail considered necessary to the representation's success? Or, if we attend to Bottom's final, quote-unquote, "or" above, is he asserting that the audience will, in fact, be able to process a purely conventional representation of something real, like a cracked wall? A similar ambiguity attaches to the moonshine problem. Bottom supposes that natural moonlight can simply be let in through a casement in the theater chamber's window, while Quince proposes something different. Quote unquote, "Or else one must come in with a bush of thorns and a lantern and say he comes to disfigure or to present the person of moonshine." Act 3, Scene 1, Lines 51 through 53. In both instances, there seems to be a little confusion here between the neoclassical precept that the dramatic representation must deceive the audience into taking something or some event on the stage for the real thing, and the more generous assertion that audiences have no serious trouble A. distinguishing between make-believe and reality, and B, accepting a symbolical or conventional presentation on the stage without sacrificing their ability to respond to what they see on stage. Even though Peter Quince betrays his ignorance of the finer points in this debate over dramatic realism versus conventionalism or symbolism, when he mistakes the word disfigure for figure, Shakespeare may be marking off the whole affair as another tendentious either-or debate of the sort criticism often generates. Audiences seem able enough to deal with either approach, or both. The director will determine which kind of representation suits the particular scene. In the case of the craftsmen's Pyramus and Thisbe, we will get a generous heap of both strategies. In any case, the unlearned but earnest actors are wrestling with an important neoclassical concern. What is the moral impact of fictional representations? Can mere fantasies cause distress or even actual harm in the world beyond art and literature? In truth, anything worthwhile is likely to be capable of causing difficulties when mishandled or misunderstood. "This is to make an ass of me, to fright me if they could." Robin observes the actor's rehearsal and decides to give Bottom the Weaver the head of an ass. Terrified, the other actors run away, and Bottom, astonished, sings. Still in Act 3, Scene 1, Robin lights upon the working men actors' rehearsal scene by chance, and decides to try his brand of mischief on them, saying, quote-unquote, "I'll be an auditor, an actor too, perhaps, if I see cause." He determines that partially transforming Bottom into an ass will be his contribution, along with chasing the frightened actors round and round until they flee in terror. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 67 through 68. Bottom, now with an ass's head, is shocked at the way he is treated and puts a brave face on his predicament. Quote unquote, "This is to make an ass of me, to fright me if they could, but I will not stir from this place, do what they can." Act 3, Scene 1, lines 106 through 108. He decides to sing a lovely song featuring observations on songbirds as a balm to his soul. Mentioned are the quote-unquote ouzel cock, the thrush and the wren, the finch, sparrow, lark, and cuckoo. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 110 through 113 and 115 through 118. Why does Robin pick Bottom to transform and not a different actor? Since the human character Bottom is somewhat of an ass in the pejorative sense, it seems appropriate that Bottom should be, quote-unquote, translated, as the terrified Peter Quince terms the change, into a stubborn, obtuse donkey. Act 3, Scene 1, line 105. To be translated is literally, etymologically, to be brought over. Here, presumably, the change is from one realm and one species to a different realm and a different species. Bottom becomes strangely connected and affined with the natural world, transformed from a man into an animal. If a more theoretical reason is desired, we could suggest that when the actors' roles were handed out, Bottom wanted to play all of them. He imagined throwing himself into each of them with great success and impressing everyone. Now he is privileged, if that's the right word, to experience something that none of his fellow workmen is likely ever to experience, turning from a human being into an animal. "Thou shalt remain here, whether thou wilt or no." Bottom sings and awakens the bewitched Titania, who immediately falls in love with him and commands him to stay with her. Still in Act 3, Scene 1, Titania awakens to the sight of the translated Bottom, and the magic pansy juice does its work. The Queen of the Fairies declares, quote-unquote, "Thy fair virtue's force, perforce, doth move me. On the first view to say, to swear, I love thee." Act 3, Scene 1, lines 124 through 125. Bottom tries to back away, saying, quote-unquote, "Methinks, mistress, you should have little reason for that." Act 3, Scene 1, lines 126 through 127. But Titania makes him an offer he dare not refuse, considering her powers and high state. Quote unquote, "Thou shalt remain here, whether thou wilt or no." Act 3, Scene 1, line 135. Bottom is soon accorded all sorts of attention to sweeten the deal. No less dignitaries than, quote unquote, "peas blossom, cobweb, moth, and mustard seed" are commanded to wait upon him, and he is pleased to be able to converse with them one by one. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 145 through 182, inclusive. Perhaps Bottom has got himself into this fix because of his obstreperous, overly enthusiastic personality, but that's no reason to be ungenerous in our understanding of him. He may have trouble managing his narcissistic tendencies and fantasy projections, but he is by no means alone in the play in not being able to do that. Narcissism and projection are part of love, too, and Bottom is gifted with a remarkable, even unique set of experiences in A Midsummer Night's Dream. This is the woman, but not this the man. Surveying the situation with Oberon, Robin realizes his error in bewitching Lysander rather than Demetrius. Oberon properly bewitches Demetrius, and Helena enters followed by a doting Lysander. In Act 3, Scene 2, Robin relates to Oberon how he transformed Bottom. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 6 through 34, inclusive. With Oberon looking on, Robin discovers his error in having sprinkled pansy juice on Lysander rather than Demetrius. Quote unquote, "This is the woman, but not this the man," he says. And then he and the Fairy King behold the knockdown argument that Hermia and Demetrius have over his possessiveness toward her. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 41 through 87, inclusive. Oberon is pleased that Titania has fallen in love with the transformed Bottom, but he is not pleased about Lysander's situation and sets about making things right. Robin's mistake has sundered that rarest of things, a couple grounded in true and faithful love, and it has left Hermia wondering where Lysander has gone. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 88 through 91. Oberon now bewitches Demetrius to turn his affections toward Helena and away from his less-than-pure, unmagical appreciation for Hermia. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 102 through 109, inclusive. Lord, what fools these mortals be! Robin is excited to see what's coming next, and he's not disappointed. Demetrius awakens and falls in love with Helena, but Helena is sure both suitors are mocking her. When Hermia discovers what has happened, she rages at her old friend. Still in Act 3, Scene 2, Robin sees good sport in the coming fireworks amongst the couples. Quote unquote, "Lord, what fools these mortals be." Act 3, Scene 2, line 115. And he isn't wrong. When Demetrius wakes up newly enraptured with Helena, and Helena, quite understandably believing herself to be the butt of a cruel joke, reacts with anguish against Lysander and Demetrius alike, saying, quote unquote, "You are both rivals and love Hermia, and now both rivals to mock Helena." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 155 through 156. Robin and a less than pleased Oberon will see not only this entertainment, but also Demetrius and Lysander's intense quarrel as suitors of the same woman. Helena laments to Hermia, quote unquote, "Is all forgot, all school days, friendship, childhood innocence?" Act 3, Scene 2, lines 201 through 202. Hermia protests her innocence, but things soon turn ugly when her weak point is found. She fears being mocked for her short stature. Helena, quote unquote, "hath made compare between our statures. She hath urged her height." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 290 through 291. Attraction and rejection touch the very heart of a person's identity, so Hermia's reaction is understandable. When they next awake, all this derision shall seem a dream and fruitless vision. Lysander and Demetrius wrangle over Helena and agree to fight a duel. Oberon makes Robin impersonate both men, leading them farther into the woods until they fall asleep. Helena and Hermia sleep too. Robin fixes his mistake by unbewitching Lysander with an antidote flower. Still in Act 3, Scene 2, Demetrius and Lysander go off into the woods to fight a duel over Helena. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 335 through 337. Helena, in spite of her taller stature, flees the wrath of Hermia. With the men and the women alike quarreling, we have reached the height of chaos in this play. Oberon suspects that Robin is responsible for all this discord, and as it turns out, he's correct. Robin says, quote unquote, "This their jangling I esteem a sport." Act 3, Scene 2, line 353. The king orders the impish Puck to follow the warring males and keep anything untoward from happening by leading them on and tiring them out until they sleep. He is also told to fix his mistake with Lysander by undoing the charm that he had laid upon him with the pansy, also known as Cupid's flower. Act 3, Scene 2, lines 354 through 358 inclusive. Oberon himself will soon extort the Indian boy from Titania in exchange for releasing her from her love match with an ass. What Oberon, a king in the comic mode, seeks above all is harmony. Of the soon-to-be-sleeping human lovers, he says, quote unquote, "When they next awake, all this derision shall seem a dream and fruitless vision, and back to Athens shall the lovers wend, with league whose date till death shall never end." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 370 through 373. As for Titania, Oberon explains, quote unquote, "I will her charmed eye release from monster's view, and all things shall be peace." Act 3, Scene 2, lines 375 through 377. The men soon grow weary, and Helena and Hermia also tire and lie down to sleep. While all four humans rest, Robin is able to correct his earlier mistake with Lysander. As he sums up the repair, quote unquote, "Jack shall have Jill, naught shall go ill. The man shall have his mare again, and all shall be well." Act 3, Scene 3, lines 461 through 463. Robin doesn't sharply differentiate one human couple from another. To him, what matters is the act of coupling, the simple fact of union. He doesn't trouble himself with the choice of object. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Saturday, July 5th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations from A Midsummer Night's Dream, I have relied on the revised Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.